أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Continuing with the Surah Al-Alaq, verse number 6 كلا إن الإنسان ليطغى أرآه استغنى إن إلى ربك الرجعى أرأيت الذي ينهى عبدا إذا صلى أرأيت إن كان على الهدى أو أمر بالتقوى Indeed, man becomes rebellious when he considers himself without need. Indeed, to your Lord is the return. Tell me, he who forbids a servant when he prays, tell me, should he be on true guidance or bid others to God-wariness? The continuation of the surah is a sort of explanation of the reaction of man to what Allah counts here as the bounties, existence and knowledge, and then what is the reaction of man to this, to all these favors. Now, as we mentioned last week, the opening verses of the surah tells us two things. That's, first of all, it is Allah who has created man from alaq, created men from alaq. Alaq is the plural of alaqa, which means a clinging mass. And then this clinging mass was given knowledge. Upon progress in life, upon development, this clinging mass became to a state where Allah taught him knowledge, which is in itself a very fascinating and amazing thing. And it tells us, secondly, that after the favor, the ni'mah of existence, is knowledge, which is more important than anything else. And of course, if we refer to our riwayat and tradition, we find out that the most important thing in life, in everyone's life, is knowledge. Knowledge is what expands human life. No other favor of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this world, no other ni'mah expands human life. On the contrary, they limit human life. The more you have in wealth, the more you have in position, they limit your life, they take your time to an extent that you cannot even have time to ponder, to meditate. The only thing which expands your life is knowledge. And this is why Allah mentions the two together. الَّذِي عَلَّمَ بِالْغَلَمِ The one who created from alaq taught man through qalam. This very, very, of course, simple thing that we write and we accumulate our experience and we teach it to other people is something which creates civilization, something which expands human limits of existence. And it is, of course, Allah who has taught all these things. In a sense, this Alladhi Allama bil Qalam is like what we have in Surah Ar-Rahman. Ar-Rahman Allama Khalaq al-Insan. Ar-Rahman, what is it? Allama al-Qur'an, sorry. Ar-Rahman Allama al-Qur'an Khalaq al-Insan. علمه البيان. This علمه البيان, after the creation of man, خلق الإنسان, علمه البيان. This بيان, speaking, is the most matter of course thing that we take as part of our life. We talk to each other. We don't know how important this means of communication, being able to communicate with each other, is. And this is Allah who has taught us. علم القرآن, and this علم القرآن comes through علمه البيان. We have taught you بيان. And here علم بالقلم, again, this is more than the expanding that means of communication of just speaking, extending it to the future generations that will come. So after the ni'mah of existence comes the ni'mah of knowledge. And knowledge is something which we have in our riwayat, the most advisable thing to acquire in this world. Now, after giving all these to human beings, it is expected that this man would humble himself before God, would submit him to his Lord, would turn to his Lord in thankfulness because of giving him all these things. However, kalla, no indeed. It means that this is not the case, although it is expected that human beings should do this. However, you would see this, as soon as they become perfect human beings in terms of their faculties, as soon as they see themselves walking and talking and communicating and acquiring wealth and all these things, they start to deny the Lord, they turn away from Him, they think that they are now independently powerful before their Creator. So, إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَيَطْغَى. Man becomes rebellious. أَرَّآهُ اسْتَغْنَى. As he considers himself without need. As soon as we see that we have no need to God, well, this is just how it seems to us. This ra'ahu, it seems to him, it becomes somehow apparent to him in this way, although it's an illusion. As soon as they think that they are without need to Allah, although this is a false perception, however, this false perception leads them to a rebellion, towards rebellion. Arra'ahu staghna. However, inna ila rabbika ruj'a. Now, before turning to that, are all men like that? Do all men become rebellious, transgress their limits as soon as they see themselves without it? Yes, they do. Except if they are limited by faith, by the limits of Iman, turning to their Lord. It's just like, wal asr inna al-insana lafi khusr, all human beings are in loss, illa alladhina amanu wa amilu salihat, except those who believe and do good things. So, this is the nature of human being. The human being is deceived very quickly. Deceived by the perceived power, perceived knowledge, perceived independence that he sees in himself, so they turn away from God, they become rebellion, unless they are held by something, unless Iman comes to their heart. Well, generally this is the nature of human being. Of course, it is not said here that there are exceptions, this is nature of human being, but this nature of human being could be controlled by faith. The third verse in this row mentions that despite human beings thinks that he is independent, thinks that they can do whatever they want, eventually they come back to their Lord. Inna ila rabbika ruj'a. The return is to your Lord, of course. Now, this has two meanings. One, a very clear-cut, superficial meaning, which means that although you think you are very powerful, although you think you are independent, you do whatever you wish, however, one day you return to your Lord and He will judge you, and He will give you the right place that you have to live in. The deeper meaning of this is that although man can go his ways, and you are in a way moving away, seemingly, from the Lord. However, this is a cycle. You go and then come back to your Lord. Coming back to your Lord means that you go into deeper levels of creation to the extent that one day you find yourself in the presence of the Lord. And that day when you find yourself in the presence of the Lord, if you have been rebellious, that day is going to be a very difficult day for you. Inna ila rabbika ruj'a. The return is to your Lord. And that return, depending on the nature you have created for yourself, this is very, very important. We think that it is God who puts us in hell. We think that it is God who punishes us. However, the very nature of human being is the sort of punishment or reward that they get when they go to the presence of the Lord. In the presence of the Lord, because that is the presence of light, so everyone can see inside their natures. And they live according to that nature. It's not the Lord who puts you into hell or in paradise. It is you yourself who would go to hell and go to paradise. I have mentioned this before several times, that all the time we ask our Lord to release us from hell, to save us from hell, to help us to come out of hell. And that means that He is not putting us in hell. We are the ones who put ourselves there, and He should bring us out of it through the Shafa of His Prophet, through other helps and means. But there comes instances where it's not possible for man to come out of hell. They have to stay there because otherwise they cannot live. So one day this man goes to the Lord, and he would see that power belongs to him. There is no independence of him. Now, after giving this general reaction of man to God's bounties, God gave him existence, God gave him knowledge. And instead of being thankful, he becomes rebellious. And he sees himself to be independent of the Lord. But one day you will go there, and God will, you will see that you have whatever you have from the Lord. Then there is an example, a very tangible example of an instance of a man who has become rebellious and who has tried to go against the Lord. أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يَنْهَى. Tell me, he who forbids. Or have you considered? أَرَأَيْتَ comes in instances where there is an amazement. Something strange happens. And say, أَرَأَيْتَ, have you seen this? Have you seen this man who forbids Abdan إِذَا صَلَّى, a servant when he prays? Now, the story, the history tells us that the story is about Abu Jahl. When the Prophet, peace be on him, used to pray at the beginning of his mission, or even before that, Abu Jahl used to go and forbid the Prophet from that. And the story, we have different versions of this story. For example, one story says that Abu Jahl said to his friends or companions that we shouldn't let Muhammad to pray. Some say that this is even before the Prophet was given the mission. Many Shia exegetes, following a tradition from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and Imam al-Reza alayhi salam, they said that this incident happened before Prophet had seen the angel Jibreel. How did Prophet pray before Angel Jibreel coming to him? Well, he did not pray the full prayer that was there after the revelation of Surah Fatiha. Because we know, after Jibreel came to the Prophet and Surah Fatiha was revealed, then Surah Fatiha was made part of the Salat. To the extent that we have the hadith from the Prophet, لا صلاة إلا بفاتحة الكتاب. There is no Salat except with Fatiha al-Kitab. Now, before that, we have a tradition from Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam who says that before anyone praying, I was praying with the Prophet, peace be on him, for 7 years. So maybe since he was 5 years old, he was praying with the Prophet. And he mentions that in that time we did not do ruku. The Prophet just did sajda. And taking that hadith into consideration, the ending verse of the surah makes sense, because it says, but prostrate and draw near. Of course, we should not read the Arabic of this last verse, because it's ayatul sajda. I will mention a little bit about that later on. That salat was sajda, actually. Certain things were said by the Prophet, and then Prophet prostrated. And this prostration is called salat here, because that was the way Prophet used to pray before revelation coming to him, before revelation of Surah Al-Fatiha. And Abu Jahl was seeing that Muhammad, peace be on him, was doing something which was completely out of ordinary, against all the traditions of the Salat that they had, the Mushrikun had, because the Mushrikun had Salat as well, as we have in the Quran, وَمَا كَانَ صَلَاتُهُمْ عِنْدَ الْبَيْتِ إِلَّا Muka'an wa tasdiyah. Their salat was clapping and shouting for their idols. This is also called the type of salat. So any type of offering respect to God or to idols or to a Lord is called salat in the Quran. So there was a Salat, according to those traditions, before Prophet, peace be on him, was given the mission, because he was on Millat Ibrahim, he was Hanif, he needed to pray, human being needs to pray. Without prayer, human soul would decay. And that is how the Prophet kept his soul completely fresh, even before revelation coming to him. So, Abu Jahl said that when Muhammad does this again, inform me. And one day when Prophet was praying in that way, Abu Jahl came to him and told him, did I not tell you not to pray like this? And Prophet, peace be on him, said that, well, I'm not going to follow whatever you say, I follow whatever I think is correct. And Abu Jahl said that, okay, we will see who is going to protect you when I bring my men to punish you. And again, this tradition goes well with the content of the verse at the end, when we says, "Kalla la illam yantahe lanasfa'an bin nasir." If he does not stop, I will take him by forehead. فَلْيَدْءُ نَادِيَ. Let him call his men. Sanad al-Zabaniya. And we call our angels to tackle him. Some traditions say that this was revealed, this incident was after the mission was given to the Prophet, and Prophet was praying. Abu Jahl became very angry, and he told his men that next time Muhammad prays like this, prostrates, I will step on his neck, I will put my feet on his neck and press him to death. And when he was informed that Prophet was doing that prayer, he went there, he wanted to do it, he went forward to do it, and suddenly people saw that he was very afraid, somehow pushing things away from himself with his hands, nothing was seen of course, and ran away. And when he was asked about this, he said that I saw very, very horrible creatures coming to me, trying to take me, and I was just driving them back and ran away. Now, whatever this story, whichever way it has happened, whether it is before revelation was coming to the Prophet or after it, and whether there was just an exchange of words between Abu Jahl and the Prophet, or he wanted really to harm the Prophet, the verses are telling us that this is the state of a man who runs away from his Lord. This is an example. To what extent man can become rebellious? Of course, Abu Jahl was the most rebellious person at the time. There is a hadith from the Prophet, peace be on him, who said that for every nation there is a pharaoh, and the pharaoh of my nation is Abu Jahl. And of course, he was a very, very knowledgeable, learned, intellectual person, so that he was called Abu al-Hakam. You know that before Islam, Abu Jahl was called Abu al-Hakam. Abu al-Hakam means the man of wisdom, the man of wisdoms, the man who all wisdoms are actually gathered in him. And the title Abu Jahl was given to him by the prophets. And this is very interesting. Despite everyone saw him the most knowledgeable, the most learned, Prophet called him Abu Jahl. And Jahl means ignorance, means illiteracy. And despite this man having so much knowledge about different things, worldly knowledge, that worldly knowledge is regarded ignorance if it's not matched with faith, with Iman. So he was called Abu Jahl. Now, look how the story is put here. Very succinctly, very summary way of just mentioning certain things, leading us to meditate. And this is very important. Whenever we recite the Quran, we have to bear in mind that this is the way this book speaks. It does not tell stories. It does not give full story. It does not name people. Does not give dates. The only thing is that giving some statements or some phrases so that we can meditate upon. Now look how the Quran puts the story here. أَرَعَيْتَ الَّذِي يَنْحَى. Have you considered the one who forbids abdan إِذَا صَلَّى. A servant when he prays. Now, this abd is fulfilling what every human being should do. after being given existence by God, after being given knowledge by God. Now this Ab turns to his Lord. This is what is expected from every human being, from every servant of God. So this man is doing what is required from a human being to do. And the other one, not only he himself is rebellious and running away from the Lord, is forbidding others as well to turn towards their Lord. Now this is transgressor in two ways. This is double rebellious, this man. Not only he doesn't pay tribute to the Lord, he stops others as well. أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يَنْهَى عَبْدًا إِذَا صَلَّى. Now, how does this man know that he is right and this servant is wrong? How is he sure that this man doesn't know anything and he knows everything himself? أَرَأَيْتَ إِنْ كَانَ عَلَى الْهُدَى. Tell me, if this man who prays, that means the Prophet, peace be on him, if he is on the right path, on the path of guidance, if he's truly guided, what does he say if he comes to his Lord and finds out, because إِنَّ إِلَى رَبِّكَ رُجْعَى, finds out suddenly that this man was right, and he is, because of his rebellious nature, was just stopping him. أَرَأَيْتَ إِنْ كَانَ عَلَى الْهُدَى أَوْ أَمَرَ بِالتَّقْوَى, or bids to God weariness. This man, that you forbid him from praying, this is calling people to taqwa. This shows that taqwa is a very general thing that everyone can understand. That means to pay tribute to the Lord, to go back to the Lord. So if this man is doing this, and still that rebellious person is forbidding him, and what to say? Tell me, if that man, that rebellious man, أَرَأَيْتَ إِنْ كَذَّبَ وَتَوَلَّى, if that man is denying and turning away from the Lord. So, the pronouns here fluctuate between two persons, between the Prophet and between Abu Jahl. What have you not considered the one who forbids, that is Abu Jahl? A servant when he prays, that is the Prophet. Have you not considered if that servant who prays is, again referring to the Prophet, is on guidance or instructing taqwa? Have you not seen the other one if he is denying the bounties of the Lord and is turning away, again referring to Abu Jahl? And the answer for these all three araita is Alam ya'lam bi anna Allah yara. Does he not know that Allah is watching? Allah sees things. And this shows that despite the idol worshipping custom of the Arabs, they thought that Allah is over all of them, and Allah can see everything and can record everything. This is what the Arabs believed. And therefore, here Abu Jahl is taken to the question, to answer it in his own way. Is Allah not seeing, and do you not consider that he might be right, you might be wrong? It's arrogance which makes people to think that they are absolutely right and others are absolutely wrong. And this is actually questioning that attitude of Abu Jahl. Kalla. Now, it's not the way that he thinks, that we leave everything, everyone to themselves. They are not taken to judgment. Nothing will be accounted for. Kalla la illam yantahi lanasfa'an bin nasiya. No, indeed, if he does not stop, we shall seize him by the forelock. Nasiya are the hairs which are in the just above the forehead. And this means that we lead them. When you take the nasiya of someone, of course, this is when there is a sort of bad relationship, when you want to take someone somewhere in a very rude manner, when there is a quarrel or fighting or whatever, they take the forehead and they drag them. And here Allah is using this metaphor, saying that we will lead him in this way, lead him somewhere that is not pleasant for him. And actually, this is the way Allah leads people to hell. taking them by the forehead and pushing them towards hell. Now, this is what we see from outside. It's very important. Usually, Allah mentions about the Day of Judgment what we see from outside. That Allah is taking, or the angels are taking the forehead of this person, dragging him to hell. However, the deeper story is that these people are led because of their nature, because of their actions. It's as if someone is taking their forehead and dragging them towards the hell. However, they are dragged by their nature towards the hell. They cannot come out of it, because out of hell for them is absolute darkness. Because out of hell is the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They cannot see the light, so it's absolute darkness for them. It's only in hell that they can see certain things, and then they go and dwell there. And it's interesting, sometimes they try to come out of hell, because neither hell is tolerable for them, nor outside hell is tolerable for them. Inside hell, it is always agony, quarrel, wrath, then punishment, hatred, and this hatred shows itself in the form of fire of hell. And when they try to come out of it, when they come outside, it is even more intolerable. And that's why we, in two places in the Quran, we have كُلَّمَا أَرَادُوا أَن يَخْرُجُوا مِنْهَا مِنْ غَمٍ أُعِيدُوا فِيهَا. Whenever they try, when they really, really, hell becomes intolerable for them, and they want to come out of it, because of this, because of gham, because of the sad and depression that overcomes them, they are returned to the hell. They are returned probably by their own accord. They go back, because outside hell is not tolerable for them, inside hell is not tolerable for them. لا يموت فيها ولا يحيا. So, when he says, لَنَسْفَعَنْ بِالنَّاسِيَةِ, we take him, drag him by the forelock. It is how it appears. Otherwise, it is them themselves who follow their nature towards hell. نَاسِيَةٍ كَاذِبَةٍ خَاطِئَةٍ. The forelock of someone who is denying, and who is a lying person, who is the most mischievous person. Then, of course, now he says, I have more friends, more comrades, I am a man of social position. Then, at that point, let him call his comrades. فَلْيَدْعُ نَادِيَهُ. Let him call his gang. سَنَدْعُ الزَّبَانِيَ. If he wants to resist, then there are زَبَانِيَ. زَبَانِيَ is the plural of زَبَانِي, which is God. We will call the gods to drag him. كَلَّا لَا تُتَعْهُ. If this is his situation, if this is his position, so you should not obey him. Now, this is a general instruction for all of us. In this world, when you turn to God, when you want to pray, there are always, always those who want to distract you from it, who tell you not to do it, who even force you not to do it. The situation, circumstances forces you not to do it. You should not obey these things. You should not follow it. You should turn to the Lord. As he say, indeed, do not obey him, but prostrate and draw near. Now, as I said, this is Ayatul Sajda, but if we recite the translation, we don't need to do Sajda. If we recite the Arabic, we need to do Sajda. So, do not prostrate, do not obey him, and but prostrate and draw near. So, in your life, if this is the instruction to the Prophet, peace be on him, then the instruction comes to us as well, is extended to every human being, that if circumstances, people, arrogant people, powerful people are trying to stop you from this relationship with the Lord, especially with sajda, especially with this symbol of servanthood, which is sajda, you should not obey them. You should do this, because this would transpire later on into something which you will see the one who does sajda is above everyone else, including those who have denied them the right to do it. In a sense, this is the sort of seed of those ayat which later on come in more elaborate way, like for example in Surah Kahf we have that wasbir nafsaka ma'allazina yad'una rabbahum bilghadati wal'ashi yuriduna wajha. You have to be with those who morning and evening they call their Lord. This is Salat, of course. They seek His pleasure, they seek to please Him. وَلَا تُطِعْ مَنْ أَغْفَلْنَا قَلْبَهُ عَنْ ذِكْرَنَا. Do not obey the ones whose heart are ignorant of me. أَغْفَلْنَا قَلْبَهُ عَنْ ذِكْرَنَا. We have completely made their hearts to be negligent of the Lord. And this is of course what every human being in the history have been faced with. We think that it's our time, that we have atheists, we have those who are very powerful in argument and they try to stop us from following something which belongs to the past. It has always been like this. Now, we don't know how long ago Nuh alayhi salam used to live. Several thousand years. We don't know how long. However, even when Nuh brought his message, they told him, "In hada illa asatirul awwalin." This is the story, this is the myths of the past. So it has always been like this, a struggle between faith and infidelity and kufr. A struggle between mu'minun and kafirun. And it's always been like this. And you have to determine in which camp you want to be. And it's two camps. As Amirul Mu'minin mentions in Nahjul Balagha, haqqun wa batilun wa likullin ahlun. There is haqq, there is batil. And for every camp there are people, there are followers who would follow either haqq or batil. So this is an ongoing thing. And every newborn baby who comes to this life eventually would face this encounter between haqq and batil. And when we say haqq and batil, we mean turning towards the Lord or turning away from the Lord. So you should not obey Him and prostrate and draw near. Now, just a finishing remark. This last verse of Surah Alaq is Ayatul Sajda. And for that reason, the whole Surah is called Azima, or one of the Azaim. Now, Azima means something that you must do. This is Azima, as opposed to Rukhsa. That means something that you are allowed to leave, not do it. So, there are four verses in the Quran, and therefore four chapters in the Quran which are called Azaim. That means the chapters which you must prostrate upon coming the Ayatul Sajda in them. And these are Suratul Sajda, Alif Lam Mim Sajda, Surah number 32. And then Surah Fussilat, Surah number 41. And Surah Najm, Surah number 56. And Surah Alaq, number 54, and Surah Alaq, Surah number 96. These are the four surahs which are called Azaim. However, these are not the only ayat of prostration in the Quran. According to most Sunni scholars, there are 14 ayah in the Quran, which are ayatul sajda. That whenever you come to that, you have to prostrate. And according to the Shia account of these ayat, there are 15 verses. So 15 verses in the Quran according to the Shia traditions, 14 according to most Sunni traditions, which have this obligation of sajda. However, the opinion of the jurists about the nature of sajda in these surahs differ. So, for example, Shafi'i believes that in all these 14 places, the sajda is mustahab. It's not obligatory to do sajda. However, Abu Hanifa believes that in all these 14 places, the sajda is wajib. Now, according to traditions from Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, from these 15 places of 15 verses of sajda, only 4 are azima, and the others are rukhsa. Have the rukhsa, you have the rukhsa to not process. So, 4 are obligatory when you recite them to prostrate, and 11 are mustahab. Now, Of course, these 11 verses, apart from these four, are scattered in different places of the Quran. For example, you have one in Surah Maryam, one in Surah Furqan, two in Surah Hajj, in Surah Nahl, and so on and so forth. We have these ayat scattered here and there. However, there are special instructions as well about reciting these surahs in Salat. Now, according to the Sunni fiqh, whether we regard sajda wajib or mustahab, you can recite these surahs in Salat. And whenever they come to surah to ayah to sajda, they prostrate and they stand and continue. According to Shia, it is forbidden to recite chapters, surah of sajda in the wajib Salat. You should not recite it. Why? Because then you have to add a sajda. And those ayat which have mustahab sajda, you can do it. You can do it in Salat. And in Salatul Nafila also you can do these wajib azaim surahs which have sajda wajiba. However, when you come to sajda, you have to prostrate. Now, in Salat, in Nafila, you prostrate one extra, it doesn't matter. However, in wajib, you shouldn't do it. And also, outside Salat, if you recite any of these verses, or if you hear someone else reciting it, you have to prostrate. Now, what is wajib is prostration. Then there is an additional mustahab thing to do, and that is to say a dhikr. Like, for example, La ilaha illallahu haqqan haqqa, La ilaha illallahu imanan wa tasdiqa. And there is a couple of lines of dhikr here, which people may say in their sajda. Or just one La ilaha illallah. They prostrate and just say La ilaha illallah when they hear these verses recited. And also, these four azaim surahs, these are specifically, of course, the Shia jurisprudence. These four azaim surahs cannot be recited by anyone who needs a major ablution. Whether men or women who need major ablution, they cannot recite even one verse of these surahs according to some jurists. And some say no. The other verses could be recited. However, only the verse of sajda cannot be recited. And it is because of this great importance of these chapters, which they have been called Azaim, and they have found a special place in the Quran, and there are many, many other jurisprudential issues with regards to these ayat and other ayat, which we leave it, inshallah, for some other discussion. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi tahirin.
Thank you much indeed, Sheikh. Brothers and sisters, now the floor is open for any discussion, questions, and comments. Yeah, Muhammad.
Sheikh.
Alaykum salam.
Sheikh, we talked about the Salat of the Prophet before Revelation. What was the Salat of his forefathers? Hazrat Abdullah, Hazrat Abu Talib, and Hazrat Abdul Muttalib. And is there any justification in this saying that some people say that it is most probable that Hazrat Muttalib and maybe Hazrat Abu Talib was a prophet as well?
Well, on what basis they say this? On a hadith or what? Or just it's a guess? Speculation. Well, you cannot take speculation. وَلَا تَقْفُ مَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٍ. You should not follow what you have no knowledge of. If there was such a thing, we would have been informed about it. So certainly, although they were great men of piety, but certainly they were not prophets. And they are not named among the group of prophets, but in any tradition, and therefore that is not. How did they pray? We don't know. We know that there was this prayer from the time of Ismail and Ibrahim alayhi salam. We don't know the nature of it or the way it was performed, but we know that according to many traditions, the Prophet peace be upon him used to pray before revelation. However, it was not like this prayer. As we said, this prayer, one of the main components of the prayer we do is Fatihatul Kitab, Surah Fatiha. And of course, it was missing. So it was completely a different type of salat.
Thank you, Sheikh. Just to continue from the point here, does it not make more sense that Abu Jahl used to stop the Prophet from doing the salah different from others before revelation, because in the beginning the Prophet may have been very confined privately in his home or whatever, but as the changes began to take place in himself, he became more and more open, and hence Abu Jahl realized that his nephew is doing salah differently, so that's why he was trying to stop him, and also maybe after revelation as well.
Well, after the Prophet openly started his da'wah, that was 3 years after revelation, of course everything changed. You see, until 3 years, prophets had no claim. He was not calling openly. He was just calling certain people. But after he told them that I am the messenger of God, then everything changed, because then the denial increased. Before that, it was a private thing for the Prophet, peace be on him. Whether after revelation or before revelation, it was more type of prophet, private thing. But the denial of Abu Jahl and others was a continuous denial. From the day they saw the Prophet was prostrating and doing things which were not common, to the time when Prophet proclaimed that he was a messenger of God, they were in denial. They were just trying to somehow bully the prophets to desist from what he was doing. Now, I don't know what exactly the question is addressing. I mean, what is the question exactly?
No, we in the beginning we were sort of discussing that our Shia ulama from the hadith of the two imams said that this was taking place before revelation, mm-hmm. and the Sunnis believe that it was after revelation. They're just trying to figure out.
So you say it's more justified if we think it was before revelation?
To have started before revelation and maybe
continued after. Yeah, that's possible. That's possible, of course.
Okay, thanks. Any sisters? Any other brother? Sure. Yeah, okay.
Assalamualaikum. Although this is not concerning this week, it might be, I wasn't here last week, but you mentioned Allama bil Qalam. We find that in the early days, there wasn't a lot of writing taking place. And at least we find that there was a group of companions who actually forbade writing anything to the extent that even a hadith was forbidden for quite some time to be written down by them. Is Allama bil Qalam, I mean, was writing not necessarily emphasized by the Prophet as much, or was it that some people were against it for whatever reason? Or is it Allama bil Qalam here referring to Al Qalam, which is Noon wal Qalam that we talk about?
Yeah. Well, actually, right at the beginning of this mission, mention of Qalam is very important, because the Arabs thought that learning writing was not important, because they had very, very sharp memories, and they had this oral transmission of poetry, literature, and all these things. So even some people somehow loathed the art of writing or the literature or whatever. Here there is an emphasis on that if you want knowledge, you have to respect Qalam, you have to learn it through Qalam, and all these things. There is an emphasis here. And it makes it more interesting, because this comes to a man who did not know how to write with Qalam. If some of our friends here do not criticize me, that no, he knew. But it comes to a man who, by all accounts, was illiterate, and he did not know how to write. And this emphasizes, again, the importance, and brings this to the attention of the community, which were somehow aloof from the whole practice of writing. However, despite all the instructions of the Prophet for writing the Quran, his encouragement, his eagerness to do it. We come across, unfortunately, to a situation where after the Prophet, some people said that we should not write the hadith of the Prophet, although they all agreed that we should write down the Quran. However, they said that we should not write the hadith of the Prophet. And, well, of course, the injunction came by Abu Bakr and Umar, the first and second caliph, and the Sunni scholars have their own justifications for this. Why did they forbid writing a hadith of the Prophet? However, according to the Shia understanding, it was done so that the sort of the parts of the history of the Prophet which was not favorable to some people, not to show up again and again in different ahadith, show itself in different ahadith. This is the way Shias understand it. The Sunnis, of course, understand it in a different way. But this has happened. For about more than a century after the Prophet, there was this ban on writing tradition and hadith, despite, of course, this verse Al-Qalam, and also the hadith which is quite authentic, that the Prophet told قَيِّدُ الْعِلْمَ بِالْقَلَمِ, you have to capture knowledge with qalam, otherwise it will run away. Knowledge is elusive, it goes away. You have to bound it to your reservoir of knowledge with qalam. So this is what has happened. How people explain it, of course, is different. They have different manners of explaining it.
One more thing then. How come the Prophet himself didn't practice that then?
Well, because he didn't know. He did not know until the age of 40. And after that, there was no one actually to teach him. It never occurred to him to go and learn writing. And this was certainly something that God wanted to happen. Because did Prophet have the knowledge of writing and reading, there was always this accusation that he has learnt it from other men. And if through reading and writing, then, okay, he has books, he reads those books, he brings it. Nowadays you would see how great is the theories about the origin of the Quran, that this is taken from Christianity, from Judaism. The Prophet has learned all these from a short journey that he had to Syria. Now just imagine if Prophet could read and write, what would have happened? So this is something that God wanted. You can have someone who have not practiced this actually encouraging others to do it, bringing about the importance, just like poetry, for example. Prophet encouraged poets very, very much and encouraged them to give good poetries. However, he himself didn't know any poetry. وَمَا عَلَّمْنَاهُ شَعْرٍ. Because, again, if he knew how to compose a poem, the people would have thought, well, he is a poet, he can compose the Quran as he can compose other poetry, and therefore this was something to protect these doubts, to infiltrate into the heart of the people.
Do you have anything to add, sir? So I think the brother here needs to add something. Yeah, go on. Can you switch on the mic?
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Sheikh, now again, it's a very controversial issue regarding reading and writing.
I knew that you were going to take it down.
Okay. It's again, you know, we do happens to find in Sahih Bukhari hadith called Hasmina Kitab Allah, you know, the tragedy of Thursday, when Rasulullah himself said that, bring me, you know, paper and pen and I will write among you, and then you will never go astray. Although my research is not enough, but I'm still researching on this issue. In Quran, you know, we don't find anything regarding that Rasulullah could not read and write. The only word ummi.
No. Ummi actually is not the term which would imply Prophet not being able to read and write. We have other verses, very, very explicit.
Okay.
وَمَا كُنْتَ تَتْلُو مِنْ قَبْلِهِ مِنْ كِتَابٍ وَلَا تَخُطُّهُ بِيَمِينِكَ. You did not read any book. You could not write with your hand. So these are very, very explicit. Mm-hmm. Ummi is a different thing. We have discussed this before.
Yeah, but it's very hard to understand. All the prophets before him, they were read and, you know, they were... It's just, why is it has come down to Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the issue comes in that he could not read and write. And it's very widely discussed between Shias and Sunni. After thoroughly researching, I think it believes because the action of Umar ibn Khattab, to cover that, it has been widely spread that Rasulullah could not read and write, while Rasulullah clearly stated that bring me pen and paper and I can write among you.
Okay, well, I do not believe that Prophet could read and write, but not because of Umar ibn Khattab, because of the verses of the Quran. As I said, there is a verse, وَمَا كُنْتَ تَتْلُو مِنْ قَبْلِهِ مِنْ كِتَابٍ وَلَا تَخُطُّهُ بِيَمِينِكَ إِذَنْ لَرْتَابَ الْمُبْتَلُونَ. You could not read any book before this. You did not write it with your hand. If that would have happened, then Mubtalun would have doubted that this has come from other books. This is an amalgamation of other literature. So this is explicitly mentioned in the Quran. Now, bring me ink and pen to write something for you. Well, writing can be directly by one by the person himself, or by instructing others to write. Now, especially, remember, Prophet was in a very, very weak position in his bodily structure at that time because he was very ill. You cannot expect someone writing something, but expecting to dictate to others to write. For example, when a king says, or a president says that I have written a letter, it doesn't mean that I have written it myself. It means that I have had others to write it. And therefore, I think in light of the verses of the Quran, we can, of course, imagine that Prophet could not read or write, but he could have instructed others on that moment. This is, of course, a hadith which has been authenticated. It's mentioned in many Sunni books as well as in Shi'i books. So he would have instructed others. And by the way, this is not a dispute between Shias and Sunnis. We should not make a dispute between Shias and Sunnis. It's a dispute only between a very, very minority group of Shias with other Shias. It's not a Sunni-Shi'i issue. I don't think so. Because if you go to any Shi'i exegete, take the example of Shaykh Tusi, take the example of Tabrisi, or Tabarsi, take the example of Al-Mizan, Tabatabai, none of them ever believed that Prophet could read and write because of those verses of the Quran. So I don't think that we should make this a Sunni-Shia issue, because then we have put ourselves against these very, very explicit verses of the Quran which says that you could not read and write.
Thank you.
Want to continue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sister, can you take the mic and... yeah.
So he would later on like to continue with.
Then just a minute, then we might as well finish it here.
Discuss it now, because later on.
Yeah. You want to mention?
Just as you said that this issue is among Shias, not Shia and Sunni. But why is it always ulama of subcontinent who are not, I would not say they are Akhbaris, they are Sunni, like. They like, for example, Ali Nakan, Maulana Ali Nakan, he's one of the great alim in his books, and many others, like, till this day they try to prove that Prophet could read and write. Why would
that's why I say it's between Shias and Shias, because this Maulana against Sheikh Tusi, against Sheikh Mufid, against Sayyid Murtaza, against all these people who are Shias.
Yeah.
So.
But okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sister. Thank you.
I can just add on to what he has been saying. After the revelation, was it still the same situation that the Prophet could not read, or rather write? Of course, before the revelation, he could not, as you said, specific ayats of Quran. What about till his death time? So during the 23 years of the revelation of the Quran, was it the same?
Well, he did not need to read anything, because after the revelation, everything was somehow inscribed to his heart. He did not need it. It was taught to him directly by Jibreel. It was not like that whenever Prophet wanted to recite the Quran, needed a book. just like other companions, they did not need a book, although many of them compiled the Quran, but they did not need it because they had committed it to their memory. Whether after revelation prophets found that ability, yes, that could be questioned, because the verse says that وَمَا كُنْتَ تَتْلُو مِنْ قَبْلِهِ مِنْ كِتَابٍ. Before this you did not read anything, or you could not write with your hand. What about after it? It is quiet about it. There is a silence here. He might have found the ability just from God, not learning it from anyone else. But what we understand that the history does not tell us that Prophet ever practiced this. He did not practice it. He may have been able to do it afterwards, not before that, but he did not practice it. And then this is a trivial issue. I mean, whether the Prophet, after becoming a Prophet, did learn to write and read or did not, it's a trivial issue because he never practiced. He did not need to practice it because he had always scribes writing for him. You see, in every occasion, whenever he wanted to write a letter, he had scribes writing letters for him. He did not need that. And then it becomes to a speculative sort of thing, whether a Prophet did have the ability or not. But certainly before revelation, he did not have.
So probably one step further, as he's saying, at the time of his death, it could mean that he asked for it for somebody to write for him, or probably...
Or probably he himself. Well, that's a good compromise. Thank you very much. So, I hope you are pleased now.
Do we have any other sister before I come to brothers here? Any sisters? Okay, later on. Ali?
Towards the end of the surah, you mentioned that it says that, you know, Allah and the Prophet was saying to Abu Jahl, think about what you're doing and maybe you could be wrong and, you know, the Prophet could be right. And this shows a sense of arrogance on the part of Abu Jahl. What about today, here and now? A lot of Muslims are saying, we're right, you're wrong. So you still get the same sense of... quote-unquote, arrogance. And also, a lot of people would say that your actions are not worth anything without iman, at least in the hereafter. So if you could just sort of explain what I see as a discrepancy.
No, if anyone ever thinks that he's absolutely right and others are wrong, this is arrogance. And we always have to have this... possibility in our mind that the way we think about things, the way we look at things, may be wrong. However, when we categorically mention something, like for example, no action would benefit without iman, this is the knowledge that we have received from the book, from others. This is the way we understand it. Again, our understanding may be right. We have to always put this caveat there, that our understanding may be wrong. However, this is the way we understand it, and this is the way everyone has understood it. Unless if someone comes with a better proof that no, your understanding is wrong, and you have to correct your understanding in this way, then we have to stick to our understanding. However, of course we shouldn't be arrogant. We always have think that we might have understood things wrongly. This is a possibility. The question of faith and disbelief is something different. Faith and disbelief are two completely opposite things. And of course, every faithful person would have some doubts in their heart unless Allah guides them to the light of yaqeen. When there is yaqeen, of course, then there is no doubt. This is the position of the prophets, the imam. They had never ever doubted because they could see things very clearly. And they could say categorically that we are right and you are wrong. Because this came out of knowledge, not out of doubt and ignorance. But for other people, as I said, it's always understanding. The understanding may need corrections, may need rectification, and we always have this sort of mindset that yes, we need all the time to reconsider whatever we know about different things.
Thank you. Any sisters? No, Riyad.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh.
Alaykum.
Just a little question. When it says that there are two sides, haq and batil, How do you explain maybe a student trying to study medicine for the first time and not sort of going more into knowledge without faith? Yes? And then 2 or 3 years down the line, something happens and he says, I've been studying all this. And as you said before, God is already there. And he recognizes God. So for the last 2 or 3 years, if he has not been sort of going the path of faith, he didn't really waste his time, really, did he? Because when he reverts, it says Rajon is in, you know, Erji. So when he reverts, he comes back with more conviction. So is there not a misconstruing here?
You mean when I said that any knowledge without faith is a waste of time?
Also, batil and haq being two different things and on opposite sides.
Yes, yes. Well, you see, batil and haq are about our positions towards each other in this world and towards different things. Yes, up to that time, his perception was batil, seeing that there is no God, for example, or no faith. But he turned from batil to haq. When we say haqqun wa batilun wa likullin ahlun, it doesn't mean that people cannot switch from haq to batil or from batil to haq. People can switch. But if he continued with that, of course, that was a waste of time. It was nothing. I mean, it did not bring anything for him which would benefit him in the continuation of his life. However, switching is always possible. And it's good, of course. Going that down that route of learning things, you see, we have ilmu dunya and ilmu al-akhir. Ilmu dunya is good for dunya. You see, when you become a doctor, you serve people, you treat ill people, you somehow people on the verge of death, you bring them back to life. It's good, but this is knowledge of dunya. And it's for dunya. It's all the time. However, knowledge of akhirah is different. It's something that would benefit you. And this knowledge of dunya could be turned into knowledge of akhirah. This is the most important thing. And that's why when you are more knowledgeable in dunya, when you turn it to knowledge of akhirah, you become more knowledgeable there as well.
Thank you. Any sisters? Sheikh, when we were discussing a few lessons back about the revelation of the sequence of revelation and how the Quran has been compiled, which is not in the original sequence that was revealed. I can't remember whether we discussed, not recently, but far back, whether Bismillah was also revealed as part of every surah.
So yeah, according to Shia understanding, yes, it was revealed, okay. And even so, in the surah Alaq as well.
Okay, so continuing from that, in Salah, when we recite, okay, apart from Surah Fatiha, we know we start with Bismillah. Now, when we are reciting the second Surah, should we have in our mind, before we recite this, even Bismillah, that we are going to recite this particular Surah, so that Bismillah then becomes part of that, or once we recited Bismillah, and then we decide that, okay, which Surah we want to recite?
It is an issue of fatwa. Different mujtahids have different fatwa on this. I know that some mujtahids, like, for example, the late Ayatollah Khomeini, or even, for example, as old as Muhammad Hassan Najafi, the author of Jawahir al-Kalam, they said, yes, when you want to start a surah, you have to start Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, having in mind that surah. Okay, but not every mujtahid would say this. So this is a point of fatwa.
Okay. Thank you. Any sisters, brothers? No, thank you much indeed, Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.